Well, for time reasons, I'm going to dive right into this, into my remarks. A young Yale graduate ushered in the era of American political conservatism 5 decades ago with a bold exclamation. Conservatives would advance by standing athwart history, yelling, "Stop." That was a losing proposition if ever there was one, or so most on the left believed. More significantly for us, most on the right believed it to be a losing wager, too. Indeed, the essence of conservatism may well be a tragic sense of life and of history, such as that so poignantly articulated in Whitaker Chambers' famous Letter to My Children. Many in this room came to their conservatism in the spirit of Chambers, in rallying to the defense of the free world of the West against the advance of communist collectivism. They believed they had joined history's losing side. To be sure, those conservatives of Chambers' generation brought to the fight savvy strategies, stern resolve, and moral imagination. But at bottom, did we not believe that our destiny was to fight the good fight for all we were worth, and then to go down nobly to our historical doom? Was not the burning purity of that tragic nobility the white-hot core of conservatism's moral allure? The problem is, it didn't work out that way. Buckley did hold a winning, or at least a winnable hand. And while conservatism may not have brought a halt to political and social modernity, it certainly slowed its advance. It did so by achieving improbable victories on 2 fronts. Domestically, it defeated liberalism at the polls. Internationally, it vanquished a mortal threat to our civilization. And so, at the end of the Cold War, conservatives settled in for the hard task of governing. However, political success has at least as many consequences as the ideas that lead to victory. One such consequence has been a subtle shift in the conservative movement's psychic view of itself, from history's adversary to destiny's child. 50 years on, how many in today's conservative movement would be willing to risk political defeat in a wager to stop the march of history? Very, very few. That is just not the American way, or so many conservatives argue today. After all, it is sometimes said, does not the American way stand as the victor at the end of history? Are we now clear for a forward march? But what does it mean today to be on the side of history, the side of the future? And what are the implications for the conservative movement should it pursue the future? For while conservatives were not, as it turned out, on history's losing side during the Cold War years, does not follow that their proper place is to be on the winning side of history and the Cold War's aftermath. It is useful here to recall Disraeli's insight that prevailing opinions generally are the opinions of the generation that is passing. Recognition of conservatism's ambiguous relationship to the apparent movements of history complicates life of those for those of us working in political society. Bill Buckley may have had this in mind when he reminded conservatives at ISI's recent 50th anniversary that a defense of the existing order, quote, must not lose sight of that order's shortcomings, unquote. He directed that comment to the political order, but also to the conservative movement. In illustration of our contemporary predicament, Buckley pointed to the alarming fact that today's younger generation, quote, trusts the government more deeply than their baby boom parents ever did. He quoted Tony Blakely to the fact that the younger generation of today knows nations really matter. They trust government. They are also steeped in the values of cooperation and teamwork. Such inclinations, they said, clearly favor the Republicans right just now, but such social facts could just as easily be tapped into by a resurgent liberalism or even a muscular collectivism. Those who seek power in a democratic society characteristically speak of working amidst the historically available possibilities of the spirit of the age. But in the grand tradition of the older conservatism, the point was to confront the spirit of the age directly in an effort to make other possibilities historically available. It said no to political modernity, yes to the deeper attachments of custom, community, and kin, even while marginalized and scoffed at by our elites for having made the choice. As studies increasingly show, this important conservative lesson has been insufficiently communicated, perhaps in large part or in some part because as a movement we are not yet at home with it ourselves. The enlightened administrative policy operating today under the banner of conservatism seeks to make liberal society more perfectly liberal through the power of state administration rather than to resist the encroachments of the liberal state. Traditionally, conservatives have argued that culture is more important than politics. Conservatives entered politics not so much to exercise rule as to protect the intermediary institutions that constitute culture from the incursions of political rule. Reagan's attempt to abolish several federal departments was part of the essence of his conservatism. Which conservatives today speak in terms of abolishing federal departments? Quite naturally, a string of conservative political victories has now resulted in the establishment of a class of professional political conservatives whose personal and policy interests are served best by the accumulation of power. Politics thus becomes the chosen means to effect cultural change. Statecraft becomes soulcraft. This view prepared the way for the emergence of a well-articulated defense of a conservatively administered welfare warfare state in the wake of 9/11. From this perspective, it explains why we recently witnessed federal spending per capita at its highest point since the birth of the post-war conservative movement. And perhaps it also helps to explain why conservatives today are increasingly in the disorienting position of apologizing for the creation of huge new entitlement programs, increased federal spending on the arts and education, decreasing spheres of autonomy for the 50 states, reversals on affirmative action, pork-filled budgets, and much more. Conservatives have come full circle, now riding the temptations of modernity forward rather than standing athwart it yelling stop. This is quite a change from a generation of conservatives who believed that family, local community, school, and church were the principal means to renew culture, and that administrative policy was to be pursued only in an effort to protect and to defend these critical institutions, the seedbeds of virtue, from the encroachments of the state. Conservatives must not respond to this new situation by retreating from politics, however. Instead, they should pursue a different kind of politics, a politics truer to their historic selves. In the past, it was sometimes said, American conservatives sought to fuse two distinct political views in their effort to forge a majority coalition. They sought to reconcile the claims of individual liberty with the claims of moral order and tradition. However, as Stan Evans has taught us, that word fusion is a misnomer. It suggests, he writes, that in combining traditionalist and libertarian emphases, we are yoking together disparate elements. I would argue, Stan says, that instead that we are describing a natural and a necessary unity, and that it is the separation of these emphases that is unnatural and mistaken. I believe that a libertarian regime is better established on traditionalist assumptions about the nature of man, political power, and virtue, than on a utilitarian or classical liberal assumptions, that a traditionalist ethic will ultimately require a libertarian social policy, end Stan Evans' quote. As we conservatives go forward, we might return to such an insight and recommit ourselves to a view of man and society as an experiment of freedom in order. We must pursue a policy based not on elegant abstractions, but on the true complexity of human nature. One of the advantages of looking forward with the Cold War era behind us is that we can now see that the overwhelming rhetorical emphasis on individual liberty, which characterized our struggle with communist tyranny, was really an emergency measure brought on by that grand confrontation. Trying to navigate in the face of a collectivist historical wind, we tacked hard to the starboard side of individual liberty. But today, the historical winds blow in a more radically libertarian direction. Some would have us ride those winds forward to a dynamist future, a bristling autonomy. The conservative knows, however, that he must tack to port, stressing instead the socially embedded nature of the human good and the fact that both collectivism and radical libertarianism emerge from a similar inadequate understanding of human nature. Conservatives should then find themselves in a position to argue persuasively in the public square that we are in favor of freedom, but against gay marriage, or that we are committed to limited state and federal government, but are for anti-pornography laws. In the Cold War, conservatives made concessions to an emergency. With that emergency behind us, conservatism must return to a more capacious understanding of the goods appropriate to man. There is a real urgency for a renewal of the conservative proposition. For as Sam Tannenhaus argues, we are now at a moment when conservatism is being redefined right before our eyes. To what extent, he asks, are today's conservative policymakers and pundits really the descendants of the conservatism of Bill Buckley, Henry Regnery, Frank Meyer, Frank Chodorov, Stan Evans, Gerhard Niemeyer, Will Herbert, Russell Kirk, Robert Nisbet, or George Carey? To what extent are they instead merely the descendants of an older liberalism? The answer at this point, I think, is we don't really know. A few years ago, it seemed plausible to many that there were no longer hyphenated conservatives, just conservatives simply. Tannenhaus, for one, is not so sure that is true anymore. After two decades of political success, how is it that conservatives are now associated in the popular mind with Franklin Rooseveltism on the domestic front and Wilsonianism on the international stage? The irony of this hasn't escaped historians and political observers who argue that what we seem to be witnessing is the ascendancy of a particular kind of conservatism that draws on some strains of the older conservatism, but very deliberately excludes others. If that's true, then conservatism today, at the pinnacle of political success, is in real need of rejuvenation. But where will it find such rejuvenating energy? A likely place is where it has always found it, on the college campus. One of the consistent patterns of modern conservatism is the growth of conservative ideas from the campuses. It is certainly possible that in the days ahead, we might see a revival of an earlier form of conservatism, a more authentic combination of the libertarian and traditionalist impulses than exists at the moment, particularly as young conservatives struggle to find their place in a God-ordained moral order, certainty in the sea of modern relativism, and leave the campus for the real world during a complex and possibly unpopular war, just as they did in earlier times. And while we certainly have seen some signs of such developments, this is only a guess. Amidst the challenges we will face together in the years ahead, I think the most precious gift we can pass on to our children is the lesson we learned when the grim historical certainty we shared with Whitaker Chambers proved wrong. There is no inevitability. Excuse me. There is no inevitability in history. No assured progress, either forward or back. There were really two grand narratives of history during the Cold War: that which anticipated inevitable Soviet victory, and that which predicted a gradual convergence of communist and capitalist societies into a progressive administrative hybrid. Neither happened. Instead, the impossible happened. Thus, when our children are taught that the latest theories of the social scientists and the political theorists about what is historically possible, we can respond with the enlightenment of the lamp of experience, that better guide than reason, that history is not in the hands of irresistible social forces, but in the hands of a providence which has shown its love for human freedom. Human beings are not mere driftwood tossed about by historical tides. Human beings are indeed free, and we are responsible. This was the same enlivening insight that came to Burke in the midst of his own dire reflections on the revolution, when he observed that, quote, "It is often impossible in these political inquiries to find any proportion between the apparent force of any moral causes we may assign and their known operation. A common soldier, a child, a girl at the door of an inn have changed the face of fortune and almost of nature." End quote. Burke was speaking of the improbable and saving successes of the Swiss Arnold of Winkelried, Hannibal, and Joan of Arc. It may now be said, I think, equally true, that in our time the West was saved by a B-movie actor, a grocer's daughter, a Polish priest, and aided by a ragtag band of eccentric and colorful intellectuals gathered by their commodore, Don Lipset, to fight the battle of ideas and to stand athwart history, yelling stop. Thank you.